You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Welcome back, everyone. Tamara here, your host. I want to share a story with you from my upcoming book, Innovation is Everybody's Business. It relates directly to the interview today. It's in the first chapter where I talk about kind of the powers of fear, comfort, and constraint. This is the story about constraint. Tina took a job at a large healthcare system. She even took a pay cut because she was excited to make her years of experience in marketing and strategy and apply those skills to something meaningful, exceptional healthcare for children. When she started her job, she had big dreams of implementing meaningful programs that would expand the reach of the hospital and the children they served. She recognized that these new programs would require some adjustment in how the hospital thought about and managed the department. But she never shied away from a good challenge, and leadership had given her the verbal thumbs up to innovate. It's why they hired her. Tina immediately went to work. She worked quickly to present her ideas to her department. Her colleagues' immediate reactions were skeptical, but she expected some resistance to start. The initial resistance fueled her desire to keep going. But time and time again, she found herself standing up against the brick wall of not now or too risky and not how we usually do it. The constraints of the system and the culture wouldn't budge and were starting to wear on her. She found herself less enthusiastic, not just for her new program ideas, but work in general. She found herself continually thinking, why bother? Every now and again, she'd bring up her innovative ideas to see if the tenor had changed, but she'd find herself facing those brick walls. Feeling totally beat down by the constraints, Tina left her job. Some constraints can actually fuel innovation because they force you to think differently and do more with less, but continual heavy constraints will snuff out innovation fast. As Tina said, I didn't sign up to do remedial work. I signed up to innovate and help the business grow. They were more interested in towing the line. I share this story because I think oftentimes with innovation, we are given the green light to innovate in one area, like leadership gives it to us. Maybe they even give us some resources. Maybe they remove some of the obvious constraints that get in the way. We tell someone to innovate, but then we leave in place the three layers of bureaucracy for approval of small things where we make it tough to implement because of the restrictions or other priorities constantly get in the way. Kind of like what happened to Tina, right? They gave her the green light in some areas, but then they made everything else so difficult that it was impossible to innovate, and eventually she left. So I share that because as you listen to this podcast today, I want you to think about all the constraints in your world. Not because I want you to stew in them. Oh no, you know I don't act like that, and I would never want somebody else to do that. I want you to think about them so you can begin removing them. I want you to think about them because I want you to think about them in a more holistic way. Everything that comes together to make innovation possible. And I think today's podcast guests will help you do just that. So Greg Shea and Cassie Solomon are both very accomplished in their own right. So Greg is an adjunct professor of management at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and of its RSD Institute of Executive Education. And Cassie is the president and the founder of the New Group Consulting, Inc., where she coaches leaders and consultants to organize on the design and implementation of strategic change. So they came together to write the book, Leading Successful Change, 8 Keys to Making Change Work. As you will hear, and I dig into the part where they talk about environment matters. And we go far beyond environment, meaning like your cube or the ping pong table or the lunchroom. We talk environment as a whole and how to really set an environment that actually allows change to happen. We also discuss why so many change efforts fail. And here's a hint. A lot of it has to do with losing track of where you even started or what you're even doing. It's amazing how quickly that happens. It's a great interview. Oh, and hey, if you go to Amazon and pre-order my book, I'll give you access to our online IQE toolkit for free. And believe me, it's not free if you just go to our website regularly. This is a gift to you for taking action, a gift that is going to give you access to a range of tools to make innovation your competitive advantage daily. And all it takes is 2 clicks. Click 1, buy the book on Amazon. Click to forward your email receipt to Laura@GoToLaunchStreet, LAURA@GoToLaunchStreet.com, and she'll send you everything you need to get access faster than a goldfish circles a bowl. All right, onward to the interview. Greg and Cassie, thank you so much for joining me today on Launch Street. I greatly appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Tamara. It's great to be here.
Oh, thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
Me too. So what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you? Cassie, I'll start with you.
Well, very little known about me is the fact that my dad was a movie producer in Hollywood who made bike pictures, and I had a cameo appearance in almost every one of them starting when I was 8 years old.
Oh my gosh. So were you like one of those random bystanders that would walk down the street in every single one, or did you have something specific that you did?
Every once in a while, I would luck out and get a line. And I think my best scene was after somebody rode up a staircase on a motorcycle and kicked in the door of my dorm room. I was 12 at the time, but I was supposed to go to college.
Oh, that's fantastic. I love it. Greg, what about for you? That's a hard one to top. I'm not going to lie.
Well, I won't try to top it, but it is different than that. So far in my 60s, I've trekked for 8 days and seven nights in Antarctica.
Oh, wow.
That means that includes carrying your own gear through the snow. And I've gone rim to rim in the Grand Canyon in a day.
So are you fast, or is it just a matter of...
No, I'm determined.
So true.
That's amazing. I love it. Those are both really good answers. I mean, all the answers are good. I'm always surprised what I learn about people, but it's fantastic. So I want to start actually big picture, because you do a lot of work in change and getting people to change and just the whole dynamic around it. But I just want to start because I think this is the thing that a lot of us really have in the back of our minds percolating. What are we doing wrong that makes change feel hard and often leads to those failed efforts? I mean, the stats are overwhelming when you think about change initiatives, right? It's always really way more fail than succeed. So what are we doing wrong here?
So let me start, and as with I think all your questions, each of us has something to say. We've worked together for decades and known each other for even longer. So we're used to working in tandem. But let me take the first slice at this, and then I'm sure Cassie will have something of value to add. It's the premise of the book, Leading Successful Change. It's just out in its second edition. And the premise is simple, but we don't do it very much, which is that one is that in the end, change is about behavior. And then if you lose track of that, you lose track of what you're trying to change. So I don't care if it's implementing strategy or trying to develop an innovative culture. In the end, you're going to know if you got there or not by whether people start doing something differently or stop doing something that they were doing. And that focus is at the center of our narrative device and trying to create scenes or images, or to Cassie's introduction, might literally be scenes out of a movie in effect, that guide where we want to get to. And it's that specificity that's very helpful. It's not necessarily prescriptive specificity. It doesn't have to be exactly that, but it really helps to define the direction, as opposed to we need to create improve collaboration between the field and the home office. Well, what does that look like, right? And that's the work. That's part A of what we don't do. And then part B is we underattend to creating the environment, which is the work systems model. We've got eight aspects of that. The environment that will drive the behavior, that will make that behavior make sense to people. We don't do that. So in the change literature and in much of the advice that people get, they get lots and lots of advice about walking the talk and how to handle the change process in individuals, et cetera, which I'm not arguing that isn't important. But in the absence of what we just talked about, it's not clear what we're trying to drive to. And we're not creating environments that make the kind of coaching, support, et cetera, to change in a particular way make sense to people. We're asking them often to change how they do something in the absence of having changed the environment adequately to make it make sense in a day-to-day fashion to them of why I should do what we're talking about here as opposed to what's made me successful for fill in the blank, 5 weeks, 5 months, 5 years, up to this date.
I want to ask you, Kathy, before you jump in, I want to ask you both, Greg, a question about the environment, because one of the things that kind of came to my head as you were talking about that is oftentimes what I see when I go into organizations is, and I'm going to use your collaboration example, because as I think, you know, collaboration leads to innovation and we're trying to break down silos in organizations all the time for all the obvious reasons. Is I go in and I'll see a ping pong table or beer Fridays as a way to quote unquote change the environment, thinking, oh, well, if I add something fun, right, I've changed the environment to get to the collaboration that I'm looking for. So this is a little bit of a loaded question, I suppose, because I have my opinions on this clearly. You can tell in the way I'm asking the question, but will you tell me a little bit more about environment? Because I think sometimes we get into this trap of, you know, the ping pong table and the foosball table.
Right. And I'm not anti-ping pong or anti-foosball. And they can be helpful, particularly if people go and actually use them. But the work that they're doing day to day is influenced much more by the kind of signals they get. And as I said, we've got eight aspects. This is something I worked up from socio-technical theory, but things like what are the tasks or the protocols, how are rewards structured, what are the measurements, what information do people get when, who gets to decide or participate in what decision in what way. Those are five of the eight aspects of environment that we're talking about, right? So that ping pong table can be helpful in terms of the interaction among people. But when they get back to their desk,
yeah, where the work actually happens,
they're not going to be looking at the ping pong table, right? And yes, that may help when I have to contact that person. But if support in the ways we talked about, we had a great ping pong game, but I'm not supported in being collaborative with you. So tell me again why I should be collaborative. Why I should give you access to this information, or why I should take time out of my day to connect you with customers that I've worked hard to get and I'm loaded up with things to do here, or we should share the following budget. I should advocate sharing that. That's not going to happen because of a ping pong game.
So, Chairman, that's a great question. And I think it leads to what I think of as like the enemy of the way we think, which is this theory of motivation. If I motivate you to change, then that's how I'm going to be successful. And I think there's advice out there that really falls into that category. And it disappoints us because motivation turns out to be kind of a short-term effort. It's like the exercise bike in my living room, right? And all that fantastic research on New Year's resolutions and changing your lifestyle after a heart attack. You know, you're really excited about the ping pong table and the foosball when they first get there. But if it's, you know, we talk about the introduction of new technology. If I just put the new tool in place and I don't redesign the rest of the system around that tool, it's just going to sit there.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of, it's a couple of years ago now, but I made this mistake of I wanted to build a collaboration software, funny enough, and for my team, because we have our heads down, we're working in silos, and I heard about some late, great technology on a podcast, I think, and I downloaded it, and I spent the 20 minutes setting everything up, and I brought it to, there were six of us at the time, I brought it to the team, and I was all excited, and like showed them how it worked, and I think we used it for 48 hours, maybe. And then we went back to business as usual because, to your point, I was trying to externally motivate them, A and B. I really hadn't taken that step back to say, how do I bring them into the change process and set up an entirety of a system? I got shiny ball syndrome. I was like, this is amazing. And of course, it was a waste of time and money. Let me flip it now, since kind of that's why it fails. What are the key tenets for making change successful then?
Well, could we Can I give you a piece of what you were just talking about? Because I think it's important, because the more common experience, as you noted, is that people's change isn't successful, right? So a number of years ago, I was approached by somebody who ran the United States. It was basically his business. His business was the United States. He ran the United States business. And he had three, he basically split the country into three parts. And he had a head of each part. That was a strategic business unit. Everything was humming along. And he asked me, gave me a call and asked me, I really would like to create a much more team-based senior team, much more sharing. And so we talked a little bit about how he was set up, and he was completely set up in silos. He was tremendously successful, and the pieces of the silo were all successful. And so I asked him, so why do you want to construct an executive team that has more interaction? He said, I'm running into problem. I like teams, and the people are resisting, and they're barely complying with what I'm asking them to do.
Well, the language says it all.
I said, exactly. Why would they want to be a team? What is it about? They've mastered the environment that they're in, and I said, unless you want to tear this thing apart and put it back together again, which is completely your call as being your business, don't expect them to adjust their behavior when they've been highly successful responding to the cues you sent them, which are they should treat their area as their area, period. Right? So don't waste your time or theirs trying to create a highly collaborative track team when what you like is basketball.
Right.
You
know?
Well said. Track teams, all you got to remember is which color shorts you're wearing. That's all. Right? I mean, I overstated it a little bit, but it's an individual sport. If it's an individual sport, don't try to turn them into a basketball team unless you want to change the game altogether.
Do you think then on that note that sometimes we move to try to implement change in behavior and structure and outcome, whatever it is, because we're told we need to versus like, hey, this is working, so we need to figure out how to do this, what we're already doing well, but do it better. You know what? I don't know if that question sounded kind of jumbled, but sometimes I wonder if we do these things because we think they're the right thing to do, but we haven't really thought them through.
Well, in the end, I'd argue that whenever we're doing strategy implementation, in effect, we're doing change. So we would be better off, and leaders would be better off, innovators would be better off if they thought about implementation of strategy as managing or leading change. And I say that in response to your question, because depending on the strategy that you're trying to create, that would argue for a particular kind of behavior inside the organization. And in the end, implementing strategy is about trying to change behavior in particular parts of the organization to get something to happen. So back to your question, it should be, we're doing this because here's the why: seizing an opportunity of dealing with a challenge from a competitor, whatever it is. We didn't just come up with this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually think that's often the part that's missed is the why, because I think people will get behind a why, but it's hard for them to change when they don't understand. So let's flip it. So talk to me about what makes successful change. I think there are two key tenets. Did I get that right?
So let me jump in on that one. I think, yes, there are two things, but there's kind of a caveat on the second one. One is create a compelling vision, and I'll say a little more about that, and Greg will help me. And two is design a compelling environment that supports this vision that you have. And we believe, and I've seen this in a lot of consulting engagements, that if the environment doesn't shift enough, if you don't get at a minimum four of those levers supporting the change that you want, you're not going to be successful. And 8 out of 8 is even better. So you can actually use the model, to your point, Tamara, to say, we shouldn't do this change. We can't take this one far enough, and we can anticipate that it's not going to be successful.
Okay, so you give me an example of, so I get the vision part for sure. I think we hear and understand that, or talk about it a lot. The environment part you've now both mentioned a few times. Will you give me an example of, I guess maybe one of your clients who's done that part in particular really well, because that's one of those things that, you know, it's kind of, environment can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. So I'd love to hear how that actually translates into what you do.
So let me just provide a context or two. We've got a number of examples in the book, which we're happy to talk from, some of which are people and organizations we worked with, and some of them, if you look at what they did, they were in effect doing what we were talking about, even though they may not have been aware that that's what they were doing. But if I've constructed that vision, and the vision is not our argument for it is that it's a detailed in the sense of let's talk about who the key roles are, what they're doing, try to create scenes. So that's a different form of vision. It comes from idealized design. It comes from history of the future or back casting. Those are all techniques about trying to construct a story in the future. They think about having enough detail to make that story. But when people are doing what they do at work, they're paying attention to everything from what information they've got to what gets measured to the rewards that are available to what they're trained to do, what they're able to do, to what are the official protocols, the way they're supposed to proceed on a particular path. How easy is it to get to somebody else or through some telephonic or digital medium? What does the organization chart tell them about who they're supposed to be paying attention to? All of those are aspects of what we're labeling as the environment that people live in at work. And I'll provide a second level person, which is this is somebody who's a general foreman who was trying to get a particular, his vision was to get a particular kind of problem solving to occur, which inside a unionized workforce, he's deep inside the structure of a large manufacturing firm. And he came up most of the time I work at, you know, decidedly more senior level, but he was in a workshop and he showed up and just went through the kinds of things that he had changed to make it possible to have these kinds of conversations happen. And they included everything from devising protocols for what was okay to talk about and not okay to problem solve about, to rewards, which included being able to present to the next level up of both union leadership and management leadership, certain basic training that he provided in terms of problem solving skills, a manual kind of measurement system of the production points that he wanted to try to advance because the information system couldn't provide that for him. So, and he literally ended up sticking that in a pillar in the space that he had also altered, which was altering the workspace. So they had a place where when they came together, they could do this. He bought t-shirts for people for them to wear when they were doing this work, which people understood was a reward, but it was also coming out of his pocket. And they had a charter that gave them some discretion about their decision making. This is one of Cassie's specialty. Basically, it was a racy chart where there were things that they could recommend and who they recommended to. So their role in the decision making was clearly laid out. So when they entered that work, there was a clear environment of all those pieces around them, telling them, you go ahead and do the work, and here's what you need to do it. We're providing you with that, and here's what's going to happen afterward. Here are the skills you should use. All of that was the environment. And if he had just brought people together and said, well, let's try to improve production, or I'm really committed to that. No, he got all this worked out. So when he was assembling this group of rank and file people to do this work, they knew he was committed, and they knew that as far as possible, they'd been set up to succeed.
Yeah, I love that story. Actually, the point for me is that you don't have to be a CEO to use the model and make changes, that you can be a foreman on the, you know, the factory floor and use this kind of thinking to make your change successful.
Yeah, I know, that was great. I love that. And I think, Cassie, I love what you just said about the fact that it really, anyone at a lot of levels can bring the change forward. I also really appreciate that it is not just about the obvious things, but also just all of those touch points with your team or employees, that can help bring it to life. So everything from t-shirts to reward systems to, you know, the office itself. It's not just, I think the obvious things that we think about, which is the kind of physical environment or maybe just kind of that like one level of leadership or all the things that kind of come together to create it. So I want to ask you a couple questions that kind of came from your book, which is phenomenal. So your book is Leading Successful Change, right? So it's 8 Keys to Making Change Work. And I know it really came from a lot of the very successful successful work you've done with companies, helping them implement change. I know there's 8 keys of change that you talk about in your book. Can you share these and just give us a real world example around how they play out in companies? I'd love to hear what those are.
So I would love to try to do that with the Twitter case that's in the book.
Yeah.
Because I think it also illustrates beautifully the point that we were making earlier that you can't just motivate people. So, you know, Twitter is this just energy burst of company full of creative people that love it. But like many startups, when you get to a certain size and scale, it just can be chaos. And this was the customers organization at Twitter decided that they really needed to align everyone who was market facing on a single message about Twitter's value. And so if they had fallen into that trap of just motivating change, you know, they would have had a big sales meeting and they would have said to everybody, okay, you know, we created a clear and compelling vision and we're really excited about it. And we're telling it to you now. Now go do it. And they would have believed that, you know, that was enough. But instead, my client, Meg Haley, was brought in to really kind of build the structure around that change. And I really think of this model as a structural change model. So, you know, they had training coming from all over the company. And she put together a learning council and said, you know, we can't train people in 7 different ways. We got to train people in some kind of aligned holistic way. And that was moving the organization lever by pulling that committee together and also moving the people lever by making sure that the training was consistent. She developed a whole new set of tools that was going to help people in their representation of the company. So tools are the workplace design lever. For metrics, they came up with key results and also sales competencies. Information distribution, they changed the way they were reporting on those key results, the way they were giving feedback to people on the way they were selling. And they're still working on the rewards lever, which really is aligning their compensation model to the other tools that they built, to competencies and key results. But they really started with that compelling vision and then used the 8 levers to kind of build the structure underneath it. And it's about a year in and it's going really well.
Tamara, I wanted to pick up on one of the words that you've used a couple times, and I think it's a word that we all struggle with because how it's often used, which is either environment or physical environment. We talk about workplace design, and that often when we talk about environment, that's exactly where people go, right? And we're trying to inside of the workplace design itself, include, yes, the space itself matters and how easy collaboration is. It also matters how you use the very valuable resource of who's within 100 feet of one another, ideally even within 20 or 30 feet of each other. Propinquity matters in terms of people interacting with each other. But it's also what tools and what technology is available in that space for people to use. On the pure physical location, just to try to make the point of how these pieces of what we lay out as being the workplace environment broadly defined, and then a workplace layout is a piece of that. I've certainly been in systems, organizations where they go to some significantly different layout without having adjusted for any of the other aspects. And what you can see within weeks, right, if not days, is that people start reconfiguring the physical space so it reflects, they wouldn't necessarily talk about it this way, but so it reflects the other aspects of their environment. So old file cabinets show up and different ways to break themselves off from certain groups and enclosed places that they work with other groups. There was one SVP I worked with at one point, and we were talking about a change she was thinking about and trying to think about how to do it differently. And she just started laughing when we got to this. And I said, okay, you know, let me in on the joke. And she said, well, for me, it was plants. She said, actually 6 to 8 foot ferns. She said, I ringed my area. She was in marketing. I ringed my area with, they were 2 to 3 rows deep. Cost me a fortune. She said, but I call it the reforestation adjustment to the physical change.
Ferns. I didn't know the ferns could be so could provide such value to someone. But I love that you bring that story, that example up. And I think I'm guessing, and you know, I'd love to hear both your perspective on this. That's why those kind of 8 levers Cassie was mentioning and having a more holistic approach really matters. And I think it's a little bit why I pick on the ping pong table, because I think we put things like that in place and then we leave those other things. So yes, I get to meet you, Greg or Cassie, at the ping pong table, but then I still have to go through 3 layers of forms just to get your approval on something that should take 5 minutes.
Exactly. Which would fit underneath what we call task or protocol, that as being one of the aspects, those the layers of forms, right, that one might have to go through.
Yeah. So what do you think makes your system or approach so successful with the clients you work with versus the failure we were talking about in the beginning?
Because we're suggesting at some point when people fail repeatedly doing more or less the same thing, it's time to stop blaming them for not following your advice, which is one way that clients often get treated. It's like, well, you didn't do what we said you were supposed to do. But then you look at what were you told them to do, and I think in many cases it's incomplete. So what we are trying to lay out is really quite different from what most advice that people get, and that really to argue that so many of the skills that are so important that people often get coached on around how you handle different stages of change or the human processes that people go through, which are important to be led and to manage, that unless you do the other things, people, it's out of whack. You're coaching me to do something that may not make sense to me, as opposed to you're clearly committed to this. You've created change around me in terms of these different aspects we're talking about. And now you're here to help me be successful in this new environment. That's not the standard approach that people take. So I think at some point you say, well, the statistics don't just represent non-compliance by the client. They may actually reflect an incompleteness in terms of the guidance that we give people. So working with this model is not the standard way. It is a different approach. It creates a different context for many of what we view as the best practices around change, including if you get very far into thinking about the change and you look at what you're going to have to alter in terms of the environment to make this make sense in the field or along a particular ridge line that you're trying to get people to collaborate, you say, we just can't do that. Well, then don't do that. don't try that change. Go to something else that you've got a better chance of doing. So we're trying to affect both the numerator and the denominator.
I think there's an unintended consequence to all of that too when it's incomplete, which is initiative fatigue that sets in. So your people start to not believe you, get frustrated. You see that's where I start to see in the innovation side in particular, a lot of like, we'll just wait this one out. And
yes.
Then we'll go back to it.
Yes.
Right? I don't know if you guys see that.
I was just going to say that, because when we talk about the signal to noise ratio. And if I'm sent to a training that tells me to behave a certain way, but then I get back to my desk and everything else is the same, including my reward system, you know, people take in that kind of confusing message and they just become cautious. They think, I don't really know what to do. This was working for me successfully, so I'm just going to stick with this until the signals become clear. And often they never become clear.
Right.
And then they get blamed, what Cassie was saying earlier. Then that person or that group or that level gets blamed for being resistant.
That's right. Right. Well, it's the they syndrome, right? I was just talking about this, about in a different contact with somebody else. It's like, it's they didn't do it. They don't understand it. They didn't follow along. They don't want change to happen. That's usually right.
Tamara, I try to use this non-work example to say, to stress what you just said, which is if I showed up in sub-Saharan East Africa 40,000 years ago trying to pitch the importance of how we go about handling and particularly hunting and fending off bears, I would find a very small audience for that, right? And,
yeah.
And for good reason. They'd say, you know, I got a cat problem. I don't have a bear problem here.
And right? A lot of times.
But if I went to the Iberian Peninsula or the Pyrenees at that time and said, I really think we should alter our approach to how we think about bears and handling them, I've got a captive audience. And the thing that's different in those two things is the world they're dealing with.
Right. Right, but we often don't take that into account, do we? We're like, here's the one-size-fits-all solution.
Or try to create the world that would actually say, well, so in effect, who's going to teach me about bear hunting?
Right.
Now, I don't like the word resistance. I mean, occasionally you've got people that are stuck in their ways, but often I just want to say resistance is a symptom of a badly designed system.
Yeah.
And that's often under, you know, a leader's control. It's a great way of looking at this kind of through a different lens.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate what you said with that.
As a follow-up to your question is that, and it's not just that the people who get the fatigue are the people who you're trying to change, you really burn up and burn out change disciples.
Yeah, well,
they've had it, right?
I think the interesting thing that I've experienced with change is that people are actually pretty willing to change. We do it all the time, actually. I mean, we change directions, we change jobs, we change houses, right? We change. But change is often pushed on us without explanation and without any, to your point, they're asking us to change how we do things and who we are actually fundamentally in a lot of ways without any support to get it done, to your point about environment and vision. So I'm supposed to change, but I don't have what I need to actually make that happen. And I think, Cassie, to what you're saying, I think that often shows up as resistance. So I'm curious, in all your work, and in your kind of putting this book together, was there anything that you found surprising? Like, I didn't expect that to be a key to change or a barrier to it.
I'm amazed at the resilience that human beings have to continue to try to change. We keep getting up off the mat and trying something else. And it really, to me, has an element of surprise that, you know, even the wizened, scarred veteran of, you know, X number of change efforts, would they get back up and say, all right, okay, so this one's different. I got it. Let's try it. To me, that's always surprising.
You know, I'm a big boxing fan and I watch a lot of boxing movies, and I recently watched the heavyweight fight, and it just relates to what you're saying about our willingness to get back up, that the one of the heavyweights was getting beat down. It's an understatement, but he kept getting back up, and you're right. Like, we, even when it seems like we should stay down, we still get back up. It's pretty amazing, actually. I actually find it really inspiring that we're willing to continually try and try again, no matter how bruised we get.
So my
older daughter is a multi-state Golden Gloves champ. So I'm with you in the boxing. Ah. Although I got to say that is not, or was not, hopefully she's retired now, but that was not parentally approved activity.
Well, I did it as a child too. It's got other benefits, but I got us off on a track. But Cassie, what was your surprise? Hello.
I have a kind of a different perspective on this. When I'm designing a system, I often say, look, we have to get all the stakeholders in the room. So I really want to make sure that we have the voice of the front line in the room. I want the middle managers in the room, people from all different, you know, sort of functions. And to your point about change fatigue, when you start out with a group like that, it's often the case that people are very discouraged. I don't like the word resistant, but I really believe in the word discouraged. And so there's kind of a process at the beginning of that visioning that Greg was talking about with idealized design or backcasting, where you have to kind of say, hey, let's try to use all eight of these levers and design a better way of doing this. And of course, when you finally take the gloves off, to use your metaphor, you know, then they get excited and they realize, you know, I can move the entire system to a different place. And then we often find that the resistance then comes from the leadership, like, wow, that's a big radical transformative change you guys just brought me. And we often have to pilot or demonstrate it to kind of show everybody, like, this is a really different way of working, but let's just try this for a couple of months and measure it and see if it works. And then from there, you know, you can scale and it's great.
And there's a piece of this visioning that may warrant mention, which would be that one of the things that's happened over the last several decades has been more and more of the visioning is based on fear, and it's based on the phrase that came out of the 80s was the burning platform. And by doing the work in the way that we're talking about, I think it opens up the possibility for people to think, do I really want to work on fear here, or do I want to work on, as Cassie was just saying, creating positive energy and drawing people towards something, as opposed to we've got to get them so afraid that they're running pell-mell away from something.
Right. So I, on that note, though, I'm curious about something that it keeps coming up as you guys are talking. I'm wondering what makes your prospects pick up the phone and call you? What are they experiencing that makes them think we've got to try something new, or, you know, we're having a shift in the marketplace, or whatever it is? I'm just curious what their starting points are.
Cassie, you want to go first, second, third, fourth?
I'll start, because I think Greg has a lot to say about this. I think clients call you with a problem, and it might be a culture change problem or, you know, a results problem. They're not calling you to say, hey, come and use the work systems model, unless they've listened to us teach it at Wharton first, and that can happen. And then then come in and say, here's a way of thinking about the solution to this. Let me introduce you to this way of working. And that's the conversation is always wherever their problem is.
And I think it's often because somebody, as Cassie just said, either they've been to a class at, or course at Wharton, or they've got somebody in their network. And what gets them over the hump, I think, in terms of, at least in my experience, is you talk to them about this, or you give them a little bit to read, and it's sufficiently different on the one hand, and on the other hand, they go, huh, that makes sense. And then you start talking about what didn't happen, and they can apply it to their own set of files or experience files and say, yeah, well, I don't have a problem understanding what happened now when these two failures, or I never thought about our success in this one that way, but we got 6 of the 8 on that. And so it fits with their reality. So I think originally, however they enter, then the fact that it ends up fitting and helping them organize and understand what's happened to them in the past, whether it's bad or whether it was good, then makes it much more likely that they'll engage with you about what they want to do now or in the future.
And are they typically struggling with, a bottom line issue, a productivity issue? I mean, I'm just kind of going down a list of reasons I know people call us, but I want to kind of give the listeners an understanding of, hey, if you're seeing these things, you might want to consider a different type of change system or process.
I think a lot of what comes in to me, Tamara, is some desire to do something with the workforce. So maybe we just got a bad result on an employee engagement survey, or we know we need to change the workforce from thinking like engineers to thinking like innovators. But the scope of changing the whole workforce is what humbles people. That's
yeah.
what I would say.
Well, that sounds really big.
Yeah. And those change initiatives are really, you know, often failures. So what do you think, Greg?
Well, I think often I'm just thinking, like, who have I worked with over the last couple of years in particular? And it's been heads of either strategic business units or CEOs or COOs who really have a change agenda and want this one to work, as opposed to some other ones that they've seen. So you're and at, particularly at more senior levels, and this is not to undercut the example about the general foreman I talked about, but particularly at senior levels, they've got more of these levers available to them, right? And then also did a did a piece in Sloan Management Review about a year ago with George Day, and we went through almost 130 companies and that trying to figure out what the difference between organic, those who are leaders in organic growth, which is connected to innovation, of course, and those who weren't. And at the center of that was the narrative that existed in the organization. In other words, the stories they told each other, and then you use that to back into how they'd set up the systems around them or the environment around them, apropos of our. And we did a double or triple take in terms of how nicely it fell out of data that was not designed to fit this model. But when we went through the data, it spoke to us. So I think that would be an example of a specific kind of change. I want more innovation in the organization, right? I want, you know, why? Because I want more organic growth in the organization. And then that's just an example of what somebody who is new to a particular position may want to pursue in their tenure.
So this may sound like a naive question, but I want to make sure we have the conversation. Talk to me a little bit about how the work that you do, kind of this more holistic approach to leading change, how that then helps set a company or a team up for adapting, innovating, kind of staying up with competition.
We as human beings, and particularly as Westerners, and especially as Americans, are resistant to thinking about things in terms of systems. This is one of the themes in our conversation here. And so if I am thinking more complexly about what might be happening here, I'm going to be more equipped to handle more kinds of change.
That's such a great question, Tamara, because, you know, I think one of the things we see is this kind of siloing of innovation right now, kind of the innovation theater problem. And that's not enough to get a company probably to where they need to be in this pretty disruptive time. So, you know, I think that you describe the behavior that you're looking for and the audience that you're looking for it from, and that's innovation. And then you kind of work on all eight aspects of the system. And the classic case in our book is Whirlpool, which is, Greg reminds me, it's an old case about a company that makes washing machines. But in the late 90s, they set out to transform the organization so that every member of 62,000 employees felt like they could contribute ideas. And they did the training. Training's always the thing that people do first, it seems. But they went way beyond just the training, and they had tools and mentors. And by the end, 30% of their executive compensation was tied to their innovation pipeline. So, you know, we talk sometimes about the strength of a lever. You know, if I pat you on the back and say, good job, that's a reward, but it's kind of a light one. And if I put 30% of your compensation at risk, that's a reward, and that's like 7 on a scale of 7. So designing for innovation is possible, but just depend on how far you're willing to go.
Well, I think, Cassie, what's really important about what you're saying for all of us listening to be mindful of is it's a little bit of kind of put your money where your mouth is, or mouth where your money, whatever that phrase is. You know what I'm saying? You know, I think we, particularly with innovation, we say like we have a mandate to innovate, right? The world is changing, competitive marketplace is changing, et cetera. But then we don't do things like that. Like we're going to make this real by putting a reward or a consequence for innovation, or, you know, we want you to have more room to innovate, so we're gonna staff up a little bit more, so everybody, the workload's a little more even. There are so many places where I think we try to give it the right lip service, but that's all it really turns into. And kind of what I love about and appreciate about what you're saying is it really is about making that tangible across the system so that it's not just this, you know, plaque on the wall, which is, I think, often what happens with a lot of our, not just innovation, but any of those kind of growth things that are future driven.
Yes. You don't get people to be innovative by inviting them to lunch and learns.
Right. No more brown bag lunches, apparently.
Yeah. It's a tool, but you need like the other 17.
That's right. That's right.
One of the ways that I think you can tell in terms of the use of this model that people are, that the organization is developing a competency for change by developing a competency for how it thinks about what's going on is, you walk through the cubicles in an organization that you're working with, and you actually see the model just posted in their cubicle. not mandated. It's not like it's in everybody's, but it's in a lot of people's. And so I know the first time that that happened to me, and I was taken aback. I was like, whoa, somebody's actually really paying attention down here. And I said, I just interrupted the person and asked them, why do you have that up? And they said, well, not that I can do all those things. It just reminds me how I'm supposed to think about things.
Mm. I mean, which is the starting point, right? Like, how great is right. that? That
I mean, it was like, time to declare victory and go home. I mean,
and I'm out. Is that George Costanza who does that, right?
Good day. I'm out of here.
Okay, so before we have to close out, where can people go to learn more, get the book, connect?
Well, I'm sure we'll be at the Nobel Prize convention coming up.
Obviously,
you know, without
I'll
doubt.
I'll see you there.
But before that, they may want to go to Amazon, which is there at Barnes and Noble, and they can click through on. I have several websites, and you can click through, and those will lead you to the book as well.
There's also I think there's a Leading Successful Change website that gets you there.
Yep, that's one. Yep.
If you had trouble finding us on Amazon, which earlier this week, we were having a little trouble.
Amazon is his own trick, but we will put all those links in the show notes. So my last question for you is, I mean, I actually kind of want to rein or make it more specific than kind of what I originally was thinking about, which is if I'm a leader of a team that's in the place of initiative fatigue, right? Maybe the leadership before me has tried every one of those incomplete systems that we were just kind of alluding to through our conversation. What's your piece of advice for people in that situation, kind of regardless of title, to your point, whether they're foreman or CEO, but that's what they're dealing with. What's your advice for them to start to move them in the right direction?
You know, this is difficult advice. I think you absorb the lesson of this model in order to recognize, as Greg said earlier, that you shouldn't attempt every change. So, you know, we kind of say go big or go home. If you can't move enough levers, don't set yourself up for that fear. And I think that's the message.
So I think that the question for anybody being posed with a change, in addition to what Cassie has just laid out, would be, what's going to make this time different? For all the ones we didn't do, what are we going to do this time that makes a difference, right? And the trap to avoid on that is one of the things that organization do is they become what I would call serial lever pushers. So they decide it's going to be, we're going to train people, and then that doesn't work. So then they go into, then they move into changing protocols or working on quality, and then that doesn't work, and they go, and so they kind of work their way around one aspect at a time rather than coordinating them. So the advice is, what are you going to do differently, but don't get trapped in thinking that I'm just going to move from one of these eight levers to another one, or you'll meet the same fate.
I think this is great advice from both of you to end on. So Cassie and Greg, thank you so much for dropping by. Fantastic book. I'm glad we can kind of share this more complete picture to the world around change.
Thanks, Tamara. It's been great. What a great conversation.
Thank you. And I hope it's helpful to folks. That's why we wrote it. So thank you for the time.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.